This is Shai Held. Thank you for joining us for this podcast. A quick note before we start. Most of these episodes were recorded before October 7th, so even though it's very relevant to a lot of our discussions, you won't hear us talking about it. Welcome to Answers Withheld, a podcast about the big questions that kids, and let's be honest, adults too, ask about God, Judaism, and our place in the world. We definitely do not have all the answers, but we hope we can help you with language and framework so you can engage meaningfully with these questions. I'm Rabbi Shai Held. I'm honored to be joined today by my friend and colleague, Arna Pupko-Fisher. Arna is a member of the Jewish Studies faculty at the University of Cincinnati, a member of the faculty of the Wexner Heritage Program, and one of the truly beloved adult Jewish educators in the American Jewish community. Arna, I'm delighted to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our topic today is a big one. We're going to try to think about, well, I'll start with a local question that is meant to stand in for a much larger and more fundamental question. The local question is, why does the Torah permit slavery? And the larger question that that is representative of might be encapsulated as, why are there things in the Torah that are so manifestly morally problematic?
I want to thank you for inviting me for such a softball question. Really curious what the other guests got.
I think for many of us, this raises a kind of basic existential question. We are deeply committed to the Torah, in love with the Torah even, you might say. And also, we are committed to certain moral values, certain visions of God, about mercy, about universal human dignity. And what do we do? How do we manage when those two commitments seem to stand in tension with one another? And if I could add another layer to this question, our commitment to mercy and to human dignity are themselves rooted in Torah. So we find ourselves at times inclined to critique Torah from the perspective of Torah. And I want to sort of think together a little bit about how we manage that. So maybe I'll begin by actually asking you the local question. Why do you think the Torah permits slavery?
Firstly, you know, these are, your meta larger questions and asking the local question are probably the most pressing gift wrap around the Torah, which is, in what ways does it speak to me? In what ways does it elevate me? In what ways is it uplifting? And in what ways does it really trouble me and keep me up at night? In other words, how much of this document really speaks to me, and I can turn to it and point to it as a proud Jew? And the local question, why are there elements in it that are so fundamentally, excruciatingly troubling? You know, no one really wants to talk about slavery in the Bible. I feel like in day schools, it's sort of very quickly glossed over. And rarely do you see it as a subject as adult education courses, meaning it's a profoundly, the very least, embarrassing piece of legislation within the Torah. And as you said so wisely, it seems as if having this on the books, with quite a lot of verbiage put to it, by the way, there are many psukim, many verses that devote themselves to the laws of both the Hebrew slave and the pagan Gentile or Canaanite slave, seems to be in stark contradiction to the underbelly, the foundational text, the raison d'etre of the Torah itself. And so your question is, why is it there? You're not yet asking me, how do we reconcile it? Do we even try and reconcile it? But why is it there? I think it's there, Rav Shai, because it reflects, this is already going to get into sort of not apologizing for it, not proscribing it, but describing. The Torah existed and was revealed and was put into action, as it were, in a moment in time. The Torah was not given in a vacuum. The Torah was not given in a civilization that was onto its own, but to a small, developing nation living around already highly developed civilizations that had a very strong sense of both their ideology, which I hope to get into in a moment, or their sort of philosophical view of the world, and also civil legislation. And slavery was part of that. And the Torah, we'll explain hopefully later why that's the case, but the Torah is reflecting that reality. So in some respects, one could say, in terms of the historicity of the Hebrew Bible, meaning what was true and what wasn't true, as problematic as it is, the historicity of it, that it describes what was happening in the moment, is kind of interesting. And it maybe in some respects makes us feel better about the veracity of the document itself in spite of this disappointing element.
You know, it's interesting because I hear you pointing to something that seems to me to be very fundamental, and it's a paradox that I think we have no choice but to embrace, which is that on the one hand, we have a vision of the Torah as somehow eternal, eternally true. And at the same time, we readily acknowledge, Maimonides acknowledges it on every page of the Guide of the Perplexed, that the Torah was revealed in a particular place at a particular time to a particular people at a particular stage of moral and spiritual development. One of the things I've always found interesting about Maimonides, and I think I'm right about this, although I wouldn't swear to it, is that he is a little bit stuck in that on the one hand, he has a deeply historical view of the origins of law, coupled with a belief that the law is eternal and unchanging and unchangeable. Whereas I think for a lot of moderns, the door opens once you say the Torah was revealed to a particular set of people in a particular place, etc. Then the question is, does the Torah set a kind of legal trajectory in motion? Right? And one of the things, you know, in other words, you begin by humanizing slavery and eventually you abolish it. I mean, one of the things that I've written about that I feel very strongly about, based on the scholarship of an Israeli Bible scholar named Moshe Weinfeld, is that Devarim is already trying on various issues to, if you will, morally improve on Shmot. It would never have put it that way. I'm not sure I feel comfortable putting it that way. But you have maybe we could talk about this later. You know, you have a series of laws where Exodus says one thing, and then Deuteronomy comes and says, well, let me tweak that a little bit. And one of the things I've often thought about is, why does the Torah not then just leave us with the Deuteronomy version and excise the Exodus version? And I think the answer there is the Torah wants us to see motion so that we understand that motion, right, moral development is built into the very process of Torah itself.
I think it was Reb Tzadok HaKohen who actually says it's such a beautiful idea that Deuteronomy, Devarim, is already Moses' oral tradition, as it were, that the recitation and his tweaks of the way this is being retold already is moving into the area of human intervention and human development. And this is from, you know, this is Reb Tzadok representing
right,
what maybe the Wild West of the Hasidic movement, but a Chassid nonetheless. So I think that's a really beautiful idea. And I mean, I do think we see this. I see this with the law concerning that the next generation, generation to generation, will be punished for the sins of the parents. We see an evolution in Devarim. We see an evolution towards that in Yirmiyahu. And there are those who say that we see a more merciful God as we move our way through the 24 books of Tanakh. And so, you know, sort of the overarching theme of your conversations with people in this podcast about how to teach these ideas to children and to students, I think that is such a remarkably empowering idea.
Let me concretize this. Let me make this a little less abstract. An example of what I have in mind. In Parashat Mishpatim, in the book of Exodus, we hear the laws requiring the release of a Hebrew slave after 6 years. And a variety of biblical scholars have pointed out that if you just read those laws, it isn't clear that female slaves are liberated after 6 years. And then you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 15, and you hear, Ki macher lecha achicha ha'ivri, and then the Torah adds, O ha'ivriya, when your brother, the Hebrew slave, or a female slave, the adding of that point, and by the way, the grammar is entirely in the singular, which makes you feel the addition of those words, almost the insertion of those words, if you will. And then when Deuteronomy finishes telling you about the laws of slaves, it says, V'chein la'amatcha ta'asekein. So also with your female slave must you do so. Now, you can argue, you know, was Deuteronomy just clarifying what Exodus always meant? Was it doing something different? I don't feel invested in the answer to that question. What I feel invested in is kind of what you started to point to, which is that already in the Torah, there's this sense of sanctioning moral growth, if you will. By the way, just another example of this in the same set of laws. Exodus makes it clear that after 6 years, you liberate a Hebrew slave and bye, have a nice life. Deuteronomy obviously is worried if you liberate a slave and haven't given them anything to make a beginning with, they're going to be indebted again by dinner time because they have no money to buy food. And so Deuteronomy says, right, give them the best of your vat and your field, you know, give them a beginning. So there's just such an interesting development between Shmot and Devarim. You might say that kind of like, you know, the best impulses of Shmot get manifestly expressed and developed in Devarim. Maybe that's an apologetic way of putting it. I'm not sure. But there's something I think very moving and important about that.
Yeah, I agree. And as you know, and not to get too academic, there's a lot of conversation about seeming contradictions about the way the maid servant, which is the way often female slaves, and we could talk a lot about how the English affects our understanding of, is it indentured slavery? Is it really a servant? Well, for the pagan servant, that's most certainly a slave. But even in English translations of the Hebrew Bible, you see an attempt to sort of maybe soften or certainly contextualize or make differentiation. But the point that we're sort of both making about, is it possible to have movement within the five books of Moses themselves? I don't know. It leaves me speechless. I'm not exactly sure. On the one hand, the internal me, and this is something I hope we'll get to in terms of parenting and teaching, the internal me is fully comfortable with that idea. But the part of me that feels I need to be compliant to my community makes me cautious to go too far with that point.
And I guess what I'm suggesting theologically, the way I make sense of Devarim and Shmot, of Deuteronomy and Exodus having some tensions between them, is that perhaps God is actually laying out for us a picture of law as in motion, law as dynamic, as part of the Torah's own vision. Let me go back to something that you said, if I could. One of the things that I sometimes say to adult education students is that when we think about biblical slavery, without apologizing for it, it's worth recognizing that we are not talking here about what you imagine in the middle passage, right? We are not talking about the sheer dehumanizing nightmare of the enslavement of African Americans. Slavery remains what slavery is. I'm not trying to apologize for it. But I wonder whether, from the perspective of the 21st century, someone might say with religious passion, these verses are irredeemable. I'm just curious how you would respond to that.
I think it's really important for us to talk about that, because educators and parents, I think, need to find the kind of calm confidence and a moral voice, a morally secure voice to make those kinds of distinctions. We're so hesitant to, even in thinking about this podcast, I'm like, well, what words can I say? And what will sound like apologetics, but what needs to be said? In just the way that you said it, what needs to be framed, it is, in fact, to put boundaries, both in terms of what could be asked of even the Canaanite, the foreign slave, the Gentile slave, not to mention the opportunities for liberation of the Hebrew slave, knowing how uncomfortable it is for us to make distinctions, but also understanding, as David Silber once taught me, that really one of the main enterprises of the Hebrew Bible is to make the case against pagan worship, and to make that case over and over and over again, meaning there's an obsession with isolating the pagan, even without getting to later commentaries, whether it's the rabbis of the Talmud or Maimonides or later thinkers, even in terms of the Bible itself and the way it legislates slavery. Let's just listen to those words. Something that until then was treated sort of like the Wild East, where anything could happen. Here we are told that if a owner of the slave harms a slave, God forbid, kills a slave, even a foreign slave, a pagan slave, they themselves are held culpable for capital punishment. But I would say even in the Bible itself, you're correct. It's not the kind of slavery that we know, unfortunately, as Americans and in the world. It is a controlled legislative slavery nonetheless. Even for the Hebrew slave during their time of employment, they do not have the freedoms that all human beings should have.
I think of a comment that Rashi makes, quoting, I believe, the Talmud in Masechet Kiddushin, Lo dibra Torah ela keneged yetzer hara. The Torah is focused on speaking sort of to and against the evil inclination, that there are some things in the Torah that are permitted as a way of making the most of an awful situation given the depravity of human nature. And it is a mistake, even biblically, to assume that what the Torah is describing there is its ideal for human behavior. I want to share a story that was one of the most, I think in retrospect, looking back on my life, one of the most formative moments in my religious development because of how incredibly disturbing it was. I was in Shir, in a yeshiva in Israel. I was in a Talmud class, and our Gemara teacher, our Talmud teacher, a very well-known rabbi in Israel, said offhandedly, you know, you could make an argument that in the Torah's ideal state, we would have slaves so that we could fulfill the halachot requiring us to treat slaves humanely. I remember I was 18 years old. I remember swallowing very hard and thinking, you know a ton and I know nothing, but I know that you're wrong. Because that's crazy talk.
Yeah.
So much so that I began to wonder whether he meant it or whether he was just kind of offering a pedagogical provocation. It's really not clear to me. But I remember kind of being launched in that moment into this kind of journey of, wait, this can't be how we should think about halakha in general, but biblical halakha, biblical law in particular. That can't be right. The word that I keep coming back to actually as we're talking is that the Torah means to launch us somewhere. To me, that's really, really essential because otherwise the Torah is a book that, okay, great, had some really important moral insights for its time. What claim does that make on me in the 21st century? As opposed to, it's a document that we come to trying to hear the will of God again in every generation. And what we hear does change somewhat.
That's really quite an appalling story. And I imagine that even then you were like a super nice guy, right? You were the guy of who'd one day write a book that Judaism is love. So that had to have been traumatic. And you know what I'm hearing in that, and maybe there are for many that this is sort of the Jewish, as it were, worldview for them, pardon the pun or the irony, that, you know, it's so inward looking, narcissistic almost, meaning what do I need in my life to best fulfill my Judaism in such a inward, ethnocentric kind of way with no lack of like the grandioseness of the Torah? You know, you look at, none of us have mentioned what animates this entire discussion is the Torah begins with a radical departure. We talk about the ancient Near Eastern world in which these laws were articulated. You can say that. The Torah crashes into the world with a radical departure from the ancient Near Eastern conception of the role of humanity and God creating human beings that weren't there to serve the needs of the deities as expressed in Enuma Elish and other Assyrian, Akkadian, ancient Near Eastern creation texts. And if you read them, and I do this with my students, not to contrast and compare, but it's sort of what I do for a living, they are filled with violence and very needy gods, and gods who see very little in the utility of human beings, not to mention the capacity of human beings. And here the Torah comes and says that we are created B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God, and that we are to take charge of the world, and that we are partners with God, and there's an element of God in it. So with this is the initial concept that changes all the assumptions present in the world as the sort of inspiration, as the literal breath that is breathed into the ancient Near Eastern world. For this rabbi, so many centuries later, to then not imagine that there is something so broken about that, that is so starkly in contrast with the entire impulse and meaning of we as Jews. And so it's the beginning of Genesis that allows me to have the kind of faith and security that as much as a ethical aberration slavery on the book seems to be, I trust enough in the general impulse of the text that it was there because it needed to exist. I trust in that thinking because I'm so blown away by the beauty and the poetry of our foundational texts. Edward Rothstein said something to that effect in the New York Times. He was reviewing, you remember that exhibit of the Dead Sea Scrolls that kind of went around the country? So at one point it was in Times Square and he wrote a New York Times review. You know, in preparing to look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, he sort of did a cursory read of the Hebrew Bible and was reminding himself of what the narratives were about. And he writes something like, what kind of people so celebrates every disaster that happens? What kind of people elevates all the mistakes, human predilections of jealousy and disappointment and attempts to kill one's siblings and failure and turning around and worshiping the golden calf after hit? What kind of people celebrate so many failures? And he says something so profound. He said, I think it's a people for whom moral decision-making is paramount. Meaning it's only when you see the opportunity for failure, which is only possible when there's absolute human agency, where the Torah, as this text gives so much room, amplifies, in fact, exploits and celebrates the failings of imperfect human beings that they can then turn around and say, it's in your control to fix this, right? It's in your control to move towards that trajectory that you spoke about of an improved ethical world. So, you know, it's possible, Rav Shai, that in the Bible, in spite of the fact that we have these disappointing elements in the book, which I think you and I have done a pretty good job of explaining why they were there, I think the Bible is something that can be taught with sort of full-on approval and excitement and pride with 2023 eyes.
Arna, I want to share a memory that I have from high school. In ninth grade, we were taught Sefer Yehoshua, the book of Joshua. And as you might imagine, I was not one of the kids who got in trouble a lot for misbehavior. But for one thing, I got into big trouble, which is as a somewhat brash 14-year-old, I would raise my hand every 10, 15 minutes in this class and say, I'm sorry, but how is this not genocide? And finally, after like a couple of weeks of this, my teacher said, Tseminakita, leave the room, get out. And in retrospect, part of it was she didn't have any tools to respond to me, and she was afraid of sort of where the conversation might go. And the truth is, you know, when I look back on that moment now, it almost feels funny to me because it was such a preposterously poor way to respond to a kid. But it leads me to something that I think is really important, which is we should never stomp out our kids' moral passion when they ask questions, and certainly not in the name of God or religion. If you have a 14-year-old who's perplexed by genocide, you nurture that because you want to raise kids who care about the world. So I think, you know, one of the things I would say to parents is, you know, don't feel threatened so quickly. When your kid raises a question, it is often coming from a place of deep moral passion. Nurture that. So I think it would be great for ninth grade teachers to say, if you're going to teach the book of Joshua, yeah, this book is really hard. My friend, the Bible scholar Ellen Davis, describes Joshua as the hardest biblical book to live with. Like, say that.
Yeah, before that memory ebbs away of Little Shai, there's a class I used to teach to rabbinical students at Hebrew Union College, a class of pedagogy, and I defined for them the difference between a precocious student and the nudnik. So In listening to you, were you precocious or the nudnik?
Arna, I leave that for you to decide. Was I precocious or the nudnik? I think what I would say is that the more the precocious question was rejected, the more I devolved into a nudnik because I wanted to be heard. Like I wanted her to hear. I wasn't asking that question because I was against Torah. I wanted to understand how the God we were worshiping could command this. By the way, I'm delighted that 40 years later, I have a whole chapter in my book about what's really going on in the book of Joshua and how it's not about genocide. But like, I wasn't expecting her to give me that. And I'm not even sure it would have been appropriate for a ninth grader. But I wanted to feel heard as a student and to feel like, you know, a teacher does not need to be threatened when a student raises a real challenge. And that's just really important. It's really fundamental.
You said that so well, that actually what could have been a really engaging, important, honest, humble, let's introduce the notion of humility on the part of both parents and teachers, conversation, she actually gave birth to the nudnik, right? The frustrated student, that it was no longer, at some point, I'm imagining, a genuine question, but really a question of stemming from such frustration. And you and I are not going to disagree on this. I believe this in terms of my teaching and parenting. What kinds of things can we sort of mandate and ask for as parents? I'll pick on parents for a moment. And what kinds of things are just too personal and intimate and unknown in the minds of our children for us to even dare engage or ask about? You know, firstly, in terms of your teacher, I have found, and it actually takes a lot of confidence as both a parent and a teacher to get to that moment, Rav Shai, of saying, I know, and I actually don't have a good answer for this. And this is awful. And this is, look at the end of, you know, the book of Shoftim, the end of the book of Judges, and the civil war that happens, and all of the images of such violence. Now, I can make the case that there, those narratives are there in order to make the case that this is what happens when a society breaks down, including the mistreatment of women, that when women are harmed, that tells us there's something completely broken. But also to acknowledge the things that we cannot defend, we cannot contextualize, we cannot explain. And you and I could have had this entire conversation about slavery in that way and said we can't explain it, but actually we could, right? There was some way to at least frame it, understand it. Understand it's a historical moment, but to the larger question of when do we meddle and when do we feel we need to defend? I mean, if I were to tell you that I have five children, each one of them deeply engaged in Jewish life, two of them do, you know, are rabbis and teachers full-time as a living. And I don't think in all of the Jewy conversations that we've had around the table, I have never spoken to my children about how they conceive of God. To what extent do they believe the Torah is a completely divine document? How do they wrestle with the suffering of the innocent? In other words, some of the basic religious questions I have never had. And this is going to sound sort of flip, but the simplest way and the most honest way I can put it is I feel it's none of my business. It's my business as a parent to demonstrate Shabbat, which I love, Shabbat observance, what it means to have a lively Jewish home and be sent to serious schools and take education seriously. But it's not my business to be inside their heads with the things that any thinking human being will wrestle with. What your teacher did not understand is the extent to which validating A, your reaction, and B, showing humility and not being capable or even understanding that the perfect response wasn't warranted could have been such a expansive, sort of religiously expansive response that instead of taking the breath out of the room, would have opened up the room and opened up the space.
I was really struck when you spoke about how there are certain conversations you have never had with your kids. And for me, I think it's very different because I don't know to what extent this is true for you, but those kind of philosophical and theological questions are what I think about kind of all day, every day. And in order for me to let my children into my religious world, I have to sometimes talk to them about it. So we talk about who is God? And, you know, why is the world so broken if there's a God? Now, where what you said later really resonated with me is that I think it is so essential to take kids seriously when they become conversation partners. I mean, one of the things I have said to a few kids who have come to me over the years, they're usually children of friends, who'll say at a certain age, you know, I don't really know if I believe in God. One of the things that I have said to quite a number of them is, yeah, you know, I don't either. Let's talk about some of why you might, some of why you might not. Let's talk about the ways the world is religiously ambiguous, why faith and doubt might be both kind of, you know, integral. In other words, another way of saying that is the same thing that I always tell people about adult learning is true about parenting too. Never condescend to your students. Education never involves talking down. In my senior year of high school at Ramaz High School, Rabbi Haskell Lookstein, who was the principal of the school, was also teaching my Talmud class. And one day we were learning this passage in the Talmud, and one of the students in the class said, wait, but Rabbi Lookstein, if that's right, and then they asked another question. And then I sort of piled on and said, and if that's right, this is a problem. And he stood there for what felt like 10 minutes. It was probably, you know, a minute or two. And he said, you know, I don't really understand what's happening in this passage. I'm going to go home and I'm going to try again tomorrow. And he came in the next day and he said, you know, I could have faked it in that moment. But, you know, whether or not you remember the Tosfot in Masechet Beitza or not, I'd like you to remember from this class that it's okay to say sometimes, I don't know. I want to think about it more and we'll talk about it. That was such a powerful model of education. In some ways that helped me, you know, how do I function in the world as a teacher of theology to Jews when I am beset and bedeviled by doubts all the time? It's because saying I don't know is, you know, Rabbi Lookstein gave me permission to say that.
That's amazing. And I would say that that same kind of vulnerability and humility and uncertainty in any kind of relationship is the energy that keeps it kind and keeps it
right,
safe in the largest sense of the world. You know, to be able to say, I was wrong. It's so great to say to our kids, I was wrong. I need to say it a lot to my children, you know, and I actually think it's really good for them.
Arna, anytime you want to acknowledge that you've been wrong in our conversations, just call me anytime, day or night. I'm always happy to hear apologies from you.
You know, I would, but it happens so infrequently, it would be meaningless.
I hear that. Okay, go ahead.
So I'm very taken with your sort of your pushback on the conversations that we each have with our kids and don't. First, I would say, I guess, Rav Shai, if they were to come to me about any of those, you know, existential questions, of course we would engage. And I don't remember what we talked about as kids so much. I had a bunch of twins. Who was paying attention?
Right.
And we obviously, I just need to say it, or they'll get mad at me if they should listen to this. We talk on the intellectual level about Jewish ideas and, you know, commentary and politics and Hasidus and all of that. But to get into the intimacy of how they feel at any given moment, I would worry that it's an invasion of something that's so close and so imperfect that actually there's no great way to put language on any of those deep questions. And I know I'm kind of sounding like maybe, if I might say, a Catholic parent at this moment, or an ultra-Orthodox parent, like, das ist nicht für mich, these aren't things we speak about. In my mind, and maybe I'm wrong, I feel it's something essentially very progressive and generous of me, if I might say, that I'm not worried about how they're feeling religiously, even if it's fraught. That's where they're at. You know, I don't need to correct it or engage in it, but I'm rethinking my entire parenthood. I kind of need to get off this podcast and see if I could do it all over again.
Yeah. I mean, I think that something that you just said that is really important is the importance of sometimes waiting for an invitation. I think you use the verb invade, which I thought was really interesting, right? You don't invade, you wait for an invitation, right? You know, I've never sought out a 14-year-old and said, hey, do you believe in God? I've just had 14-year-olds come to me and say, I have hilariously, one kid in my daughter's school, my daughter is 11, approached her and said, I think I need to talk to your dad. This happened just a couple weeks ago. And she was like, why? And he was like, I don't know if I believe in God. And I was like, okay, great. You know, tell him to come over and I'll tell him, I don't know if I believe in God either. And we'll start from there. But the invitation piece is actually a very moving formulation to me, what you're talking about, which is like being welcomed in. And that, of course, ties to everything you've talked about love. Do your kids trust you enough? I mean, I feel so happy that it seems like my two oldest, because my youngest one is too young, but my two oldest kids seem to feel very comfortable telling me all the things that they're struggling to believe or affirm or observe. And I, in a funny way, this is the very anti-traditional response. I feel, oh, I must be doing something right if they feel safe sharing that with me.
I think your kids are deeper and smarter than mine. I'm just going to put it out there. Secondly, I'm just thinking about like bring your parents to work day. It could be like my dad, the theologian, and you could come in and show up in their schools and talk about all these deep questions, and someone else is like the pediatrician.
Yes, exactly.
Arna, bottom line, last word, kid comes to you and says, why is slavery permitted in the Torah? How can that be? Arna, what language does a parent need? What framing would be helpful to them in addressing questions like this?
So I think the most basic and helpful and emboldening framing is to simply not be scared. Not be scared of what they find in the Torah that doesn't feel perfect. To not be scared of the knowledge they may not have, to not be scared of their own notions that they may be afraid to share, that it's really all good and that the art, at the risk of sounding colloquial, is in the conversation, in the deep conversation, and not to feel that you need to fix things, just engage in them and with them.
I really love that as a way of thinking about Judaism. Arna, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. This has been an incredibly fruitful conversation, and I'm so grateful for your time.
Shai, this was an honor for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you. To all of you listening, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you'll join us next time for another installment of Many Questions and Answers Withheld. Answers Withheld is produced by Hadar, with special thanks to Rabbi Effie Unterman, Mara Bronfeld, Sam Greenberg, and Chana Kupitz. Thank you to David Chabinsky for recording and editing this episode.